Welcome back. So, did anybody bring their book today? Okay. If you have your book, get a. Well, we could look at something here. I'll look at one of Cauchy's arguments here on page 777. So, if I'm the only one that has it, maybe I can get it on the document camera. Probably just me. Okay. Maybe this is kind of a. Modern translation, if you will, of Cauchy's argument. So I'll use more symbols and fewer words to shorten it up. Okay. All right. So basically, Cauchy, big step up from a lot of his predecessors. Actually cares about defining things like integrability, right? As opposed to just the antiderivative concept. Actual, area under a curve concept. Integrability. Continuity. Point. Things like convergence of series. I should put a little asterisk on this one. Come back to that. So let me give kind of a translation here of, like, say, integrability. Epsilon greater than zero. Now this is my translation of what he said into slightly more modern and hence much shorter writing, trying to be less wordy. You should read the chapter 22, section 1 yourself and see how he talks about it. This is essentially the modern definition that I still teach. Such that for all partitions P, Q of this big interval A to B into subintervals, all of width less than delta the the sums, call them SP and SQ, less than epsilon. Tekoshi actually defines integrals as, limits of approximate areas under a curve, using the rectangle approximation. Okay. Okay, so I've kind of given a modern translation of Cauchy's definition of integrability and continuity. And he argues that continuity if you're continuous at every point then on this interval say then that implies integrability. Here's the proof. Okay. How would we get this? So here's Cauchy's argument. First of all, I need to tell you, I didn't give a complete definition. What are these sums SP and SQ? Right.
So
these are like Riemann sums. We'll get to Riemann a bit, Cauchy only uses the left end point. Okay, so if P is a cuts like this, let's say we have this interval from A to B, and this is, and we cut it up into four subintervals here, right? Then the sum here, it's like a Riemann sum in that you have a rectangular approximation. But he always uses the left end point to get the height. In this example, in terms of my picture, I can imagine some kind of function here. Maybe it does that, right? Cauchy always uses the left endpoints to get the heights. Look like this. Riemann says you ought to consider what happens if you use another point on the curve in the subinterval to get the height. His definition is a little different. It requires a little bit more. Okay. So I can read what Cauchy says. Cauchy's idea is these Cauchy says, okay, well, given these P and Q, you
with
All subintervals small enough.
What would be the difference between SP and SQ? He only really considers the case where P, where Q is what's called a refinement of P, where you cut in, where Q is obtained from P by cutting P up into more pieces. So he's thinking, okay, if this is P, then another Q one where I cut up into more parts, right? Maybe there's another cut right here. Maybe there's some more cuts in here. That's the same, but maybe there's another cut here. What's the difference between these? Well, you've got some difference right there. Some difference right there. And right there. So he says, well, if you make the delta small enough, right, the subintervals small enough, you can have the difference between the heights of, you know, of these different points on the curve be small too. So the idea is, choose the, you know, look at your definition of continuity here. By continuity, if you have, each of these P intervals, and hence also all the smaller Q intervals, each less than delta wide, then you could make The difference is in height as small as you want. The idea is on this whole interval here, right, from here to here, on this interval it should be less than epsilon over b minus a. And then same here and here. The idea is all of these blue rectangles that are the difference between these two partitions will end up having height less than epsilon over b minus a, but then the total width of the whole thing is b minus a. So the area will be less than epsilon. Now, there's you know, various places where you can complain about the proof. Some complaints are easy to fix. Like, one complaint is, well, you know, what if, you know, P and Q are not the kind where Q came from cutting up P more? Well, the way to address that is to say, well, if you give me any two partitions, P and Q, with small enough subintervals, I could put their cuts together and make up a third partition that comes from cutting both P and Q more. And then all three of these partitions, using this kind of argument, will all be, P will be close to R, which as I said, refines P, but R will also refine Q, so Q will also be close to R. So you could make them both epsilon over 2 close together, and then they'd both be epsilon close together. So you can address that argument that he's not handling the general case. And the real objection, though, the real problem with this is that the epsilon here, the difference in these heights, it depends, right? When you look over here, you know, you say, okay, you know, there's an x and epsilon, and it depends on what point you're at. How small you need to get delta to be to hit your target of, say, less than epsilon over b minus a. Koshy just says, you know, okay, well, you know, for each of these little things where you're worried about the difference, you know, between like this height and that height, or this height and that height, this height and that height, all of those, you know, you could say, well, you know, you compare, you know, you have continuity here, so, you know, I make the delta small enough, but you need the delta to work here, but you also need a delta small enough to work at this point, so that when I go over here, the height hasn't changed too much. And it's not clear why, you know, following Koshy's argument, you can get one delta here that will work for all of your x's at the same time. And that was a problem that it's a subtle little thing here. See, this delta depends on both the epsilon and the x naught. So here there's kind of, you want to control the height, but by controlling the inputs, but how fine a control do you need? Well, it depends on where you're at. If the curve is really steep, you know, you need a really small delta to do the job for a given epsilon. If the curve is really flat, you know, even a big delta might be good enough. So the problem with this argument you can't really fix without a whole nother argument, a very, very big change to the argument, is the fact that the delta you're picking here, how do you know that it works for all the x's? And so the modern way we prove continuity implies integrability on a closed interval is we have this intermediate concept of uniform continuity. So this is an example of how Cauchy was much more rigorous, and he actually cares about these defining these things, and he wants to actually prove things like continuity implies integrability according to some definition. But there's still some things where the arguments need to be made more rigorous. And if you look at Cauchy's original arguments, you can see why he can fall into these little mistakes. It's because he's thinking a lot of times intuitively about, well, we make these really small. Essentially, he's still thinking in terms of infinitesimals in some place. So he hasn't completely gotten rid of that stuff, made it rigorous. Cauchy says, here's how he writes things, he's more wordy. It is important to observe that if the numerical values of the elements x sub I plus 1 minus x sub I, so these interval widths here, become very small, and the number n, that's the number of integrals, like in this example it's 4, if the number n very large, the method of division will have only an insensible influence on the value of s. Insensible influence. That I translated for you into given any epsilon, right? I can make these sums, which are left-hand rule Riemann sums, less than epsilon apart. But his original wording was if you get these things to be a very large number of thin intervals, then the difference between these different sums is insensible. The method of division will have only an insensible influence, right? So even unpacking exactly what you mean by this sort of thing can be a little bit. And when it gets to this part of the argument here in his proof, what does he say on page 778? He says, if we let the numerical values of the lengths of the subdivisions decrease indefinitely by increasing their number, the value of S ultimately becomes sensibly constant, S being these sums here. Or, in other words, it will end by attaining a certain limit that will depend uniquely on the form of the function x and extreme values, x to the root of x. I skipped a sentence there. Given any two sufficiently small subdivisions, one can take a third which subdivides each. The value of the sum for this third is then arbitrarily close to the values of each of the original two. That's how he handles the case where these aren't obtained one by subdividing the other. So he already handles that generalization. And, okay. So, the way Cauchy wrote the difference between the sums was he had some epsilon that stood for the height difference, like an epsilon 1, epsilon, I guess epsilon 1, epsilon 2, epsilon 3, epsilon 4, epsilon 5, epsilon 6, epsilon 7, epsilon 8. Yeah, in this picture there'd be an 8 little epsilons representing the different height differences. And Cauchy then argued that if the subintervals are sufficiently small, each of these epsilons, and consequently the largest of those epsilons, will be very close to zero. So that the taking of a subpartition does not change the value of the sum appreciably. All this wordy stuff. Weierstrass was a continuity versus uniform continuity.
I mean, in modern, very abbreviated notation, the continuity, you know, it's like continuity at every point. So you say something like, for every x naught, for every epsilon positive, there exists a delta positive. Modern abbreviated notation such that for all x, if x minus x naught is less than delta, then f of x minus f of x naught is less than epsilon. Right. See, Weierstrass is the first guy, and then we have Unregulated. He really notices, you know, that, okay, you know, in a definition like this, the delta depends on the epsilon and the x naught, and like in the concept of uniform continuity, which is due to Heine, the order changes. For every epsilon, there is a delta that's supposed to work at every point x naught. So instead of being this is continuous at every point, and this will be uniformly continuous. The dependence change. And was a lot more rigorous in some things, but he hits some places where he was still not rigorous enough. Now, in this case, you know, it's okay because, in some sense, because although his proof isn't quite rigorous, the result is true, right? If you're continuous on every point in a closed interval, then you're actually uniformly continuous. Which then implies you're integrable. So this is, you know, the rigorous version, the way we do it today. That's all. And of course, it's not, you know, it's not obvious, right? That's right, but Heine didn't just define uniform continuity, but he was the one that actually proved, you know, if you're he was the first one to prove it. If you're actually continuous at every point on a closed interval, well, closed intervals have this special property that implies uniform continuity. Now, Cauchy also said this, right? If for a sequence, say of you have a sequence of continuous functions,
if the sum let's say it goes from 1 to infinity, if this sum converges for each x, then the sum of all these functions, right, is continuous. So if you add up a series of continuous functions, you get another continuous function.
Now this is actually false.
And the problem is right here. Let's call this sum function u, where you add up all the functions. Right. So Weierstrass also considers this, because what happened was people like Fourier, you know, they looked at Fourier series and they found counterexamples.
Weierstrass.
Showed that to make a proof like Cauchy's proof work, you needed to put in some more uniformity. So this is a well-known one. This is the sawtooth curve. Okay, so this will be, say, U1. This will be U2. And U is going to be the sum, it's not trivial at all to prove this, but you can prove that this sum actually does converge for all x. Right? Okay. Now, if you graph it, as I said, it's a sawtooth. It looks like this. These jump discontinuities like this, and it's periodic. It has a period I, but it's just like that. My lines aren't very straight, but this is supposed to be the x-axis, right? And maybe this is I'm graphing u of x here. Right?
Did I get that right?
No, it's not the origin. Origin's not a discontinuity. It's continuous at its origin. It's like the origin here. But then you go, you know, pi over 2 either way,
from the origin. Bam, discontinuity. And just repeats itself, period pi, like this. And the height of this jump is it's a pi over 4. Right? So it goes up to pi over 4, then it drops down to 0. And then on the other side, it's a jump down to negative pi over 4. And this pattern just repeats. Okay. Such things, we add a bunch of trig functions like this with integral multiples of
the same frequency are still called Fourier series to this day.
So each of these sine waves, right? Sine of x, negative a half sine of 2x, these are all continuous. But when you add them all up, you get discontinuities, even though the sum converges at every point. Talk about the definition of continuity. So let's talk about what does it mean to converge here? You say something like, for all x, for all epsilon greater than 0, you say something like, if you add up enough of the terms, then it's as close as you want. So look at the difference between your approximation, where you go out to term n. And that difference is supposed to be less than epsilon. It doesn't fit very well there. Maybe I should write it on its own line. Even a modern translation. Okay. Now, in that sense, the series of functions with a modern emphasis, it converges point-wise. Right? For each point, you can get as close as you want to this u of x function value by adding up a large number of terms. The problem is this, how many terms do you need to add? Just like we have the problem here where the delta depends on which point you're at. I have the same problem here. You're saying, okay, if you add up enough terms where capital N is the cutoff for enough, right, then you get a good approximation of the final function. But which point you're at may affect how many terms you need for an epsilon good approximation. So this minimum number of terms you need, that can depend on x as well as on epsilon. Okay, it's not a problem you can fix. I mean, it's not like, unlike the integrability theorem, this is just false. There are counterexamples. So, Weierstrass says, if the series of functions, he invents a new concept, uniformly converges, right, to u of x and each un function, right, each of the terms you're adding up is continuous, then u is continuous. Uniformly converges.
With the uniform, it's just like over here. You need to take this dependence on a point, and you need to have this, like in this case, the capital N. It should only depend on the epsilon. This for all x quantifier needs to move over here. So our definition would be, where is this? You have to make a stronger assumption. It says that you can get an epsilon good approximation of the final function by adding up a large number of terms, where how large that number of terms has to be only depends on the epsilon. You know, it doesn't depend on which point, right? If n is big enough, then this approximation is good for all x's at the same time. Hence the word uniformly. You can use this n to get an epsilon good approximation at every point, all at once. It's uniform. So this is due to Weierstrass, and he defines this as well. Right? Defines this, and it's easy to see. If you look at Cauchy's proof, the idea of the proof is essentially, I can write Cauchy's idea. The idea is for n large, right? Bigger than or equal to some capital N, right? You should have that. In the definition of continuity, you have you want to have x naught close to x. Right? Here's the informal version. If x naught is close to x, right, then u of x naught will be approximated by summing up a bunch of terms, right? Okay. Because the function is continuous at x naught. Well, each of these functions is continuous, right? The ones that we're adding up. Okay, no, hold on. Misspoke. Because the series converges at x naught, this is approximated by this with n large. And that's by convergence. Then by continuity of these guys, this is approximately what you have at this nearby point x. And then since the sum also converges at x, this should be approximate u of x, right? That's the idea. But it doesn't work in this situation, because all this the question of how close do all these things have to be, right? And how large does n have to be? The problem is in the definition of continuity, you would need all the points near x naught to have function values close to the function value at x naught. And so depending on which x you pick here, you may need a different number n here of terms to get this good approximation here. And so you have to use it many different n's. But if you use a different number of terms, then that affects how close x and x naught need to be to make these two finite sums of continuous functions actually have close output values. See, right here, how close to x and x naught have to be Well, that depends on which functions we're talking about here. So if we change n, right, then we might need to make these come closer together. So yeah. So there were counterexamples were found, and Weierstrass is more rigorous about it and gives you the correct version. If you assume something stronger, like uniform convergence, which this does not converge uniformly, for example, then you get what you need.
Questions or comments about this? This stuff is, from one point of view, it seems like really basic logical reasoning errors. If you're thinking about it very mechanically, of okay, I have certain conditions, you know, given this, there exists that, such that given this and this, we have that. Either there's a... Can you get a logical proof that, just following the rules of inference? From our point of view, Cauchy's proof, didn't fall, skipped some steps, and, I checked, it turned out that was important. But... if you're thinking about it in terms of, what kind of informal geometric arguments you could have in your mind and just trying to write down a convincing argument, then the mistake seems a lot more understandable, and appreciating the difference, between, say, uniform convergence and just regular old pointwise convergence, actually seeing it, having some pictures in your mind, there's a subtle distinction there. For a long time, there weren't functions like this, right? People hadn't thought about stuff like this. And so they didn't have, these weird kind of examples to warn them, you can't just use your intuition here. If you actually want to have a proof given the definitions you're using, you have to be careful to actually reason from your definitions. Turns out that the definitions leave room for in this case, kind of weird examples. And most modern mathematics since then, if you look at, say, analysis, which studies, this kind of stuff, there's two things you can do. One theme is, let's try to make stronger assumptions so that we can work in realms where, this kind of, pathology, at least from one point of view, doesn't happen. So we can focus on what we really care about, right? If you're interested, in learning, about smooth curves, if you're not interested in these kinds of curves, then what you should be doing is you should be making additional assumptions, right? And there's lots of mathematicians nowadays that they're just studying smooth stuff, right? And what kind of properties smooth curves have. Right? So one project is, we make some stronger assumptions to avoid pathologies that started turning up in the 1800s. Right? All this stuff here is 1800s, right? Yeah. And we focus on the stuff, answering questions about the stuff we like. Other people think the pathology, so-called, are not pathological. They're really interesting. Hey, this is great. We can do that because something interesting like this could happen. Continuous functions adding up to discontinuous functions. Let's study all this weird stuff and figure out you know, exactly when can we find a counterexample to this implies that, right? Be as general as we can, right?
Koshy actually say it. He says,
this Koshy to clarify his definition, Koshy stated what has become known as the Koshy criterion for convergence. Convergence could be assured, could only be assured if the various sums where you take, say, an plus an plus 1, you're just adding up two of them, or an plus an plus 1 plus an plus 2, so you add up three of them, or even an arbitrarily long one. So, quote, taken from the first in whatever number one wishes. Okay, so that means I can add up as many as I want. That's why I wrote for all m here. Okay, and then he says, finish by constantly having an absolute value less than any assignable limit. Okay, so less than any assignable limit, that's my for every epsilon. Okay, and then he says, finish by constantly having. Okay, so that means eventually, right? And so after some finite wait time cap that I'm calling capital N here, these sums constantly, so I wrote for all lowercase n greater than or equal to capital N. So after a while, you know, if you wait a finite amount of time, if n is large enough, then all the large values of n here will have this property that if you start at one of those terms and you add up as many as you want, the sum will be less than epsilon. Now, this is not quite a definition. I mean, he doesn't, I guess, you could, if you wanted, you could take it as a definition, but Koshy didn't like give it as a definition. He just said, gives us an if and only if. You could take it as a definition. The reason that is because he doesn't really define convergence per se. He gives lots of examples, and he says that convergence is equivalent to this. But at least in his mind, it wasn't exactly the definition.
I mean, what does this mean? I mean, usually we think of convergent as, you know, this converges to some real number, right? Well, if you're talking about a series, you know, often we don't know what real number the series converges to, right? So, ultimately, a rigorous definition of convergence, you want to say, a series converges to some real number. Well, what's a real number?
We'd like a
actual definition of what a real number is, right? Because you want to say naturally, well, a series is convergent if it converges to some real number.
Okay, but now I ask you, okay, you just told me real number is part of your definition. What's a real number? Right? The definition's incomplete
if we don't actually define what a real number is. The natural is that, yeah, well, it converges if it converges to some real number. So what's a real number? And here, like, how could you hope to prove this thing? You want to take a series converges to some real number if and only if, for every epsilon, if you look at sums of terms that start late in the series, then no matter how many you add together, it stays small. Right? You want to show that that's equivalent to being convergent to some real number. Only with such a definition could you prove this Cauchy criterion. Cauchy gave examples, but he never gave you a proof of it. He asserted it, and he had examples. Not proof. Now, that sort of leads us to the next section. Time to go further in the book. So we're not going to do all of chapter 22. We'll look more at section 2.
Chapter 22. So we're going to look at definitions of real numbers. There's the two most common ones used today are one that's due to Cauchy, actually. And then another one due to a guy named Dedekind. Talk a lot about set theory because that's, you know, my research area. But the stuff we've been doing today is, you know, like mid-1800s, and here we're, by the time we get to Cantor and set theory, now we're talking about, you know, around 1870, second half of the 19th century. Okay. And so this push in Europe that happened then is more and more rigor, get proofs where, if you do things as rigorously as Weierstrass does, you won't get caught with a counterexample like Cantor did. They make things more and more rigorous.
But the section title of this 22.2, it's the arithmetization of analysis, because ultimately what Cantor and Dedekind do is they take the definition of a real number and it's defined in terms of rational numbers, which are fractions of natural numbers. So everything gets reduced to arithmetic, stuff you can do with natural numbers. Okay. And, I'll save that for next time. Any other questions, comments? Okay, you got that one more homework to do on Wednesday.